session number 30388, reel 7.
Had an experience with a V2. In fact, two experiences. I pride myself in boasting that I was one of the first people in the London area to be affected, though not injured, by the first V2 to land, which was in Croydon. It was a very hot summery day with dark cloud and a thunderstorm was in the air. And I was actually on duty in the regulating office, and that was on the ground floor, of course. There was a big flower bed and the sentry stood by the door. I was talking to him. And all of a sudden there was this mighty explosion. And I overbalanced and fell into the flower bed outside. My friend was killing himself laughing. No damage done. Went back indoors. And a week later we heard that that was actually the first V2 to land in the London area. It was, I don't know what it was, must have been the shock of this enormous explosion. And shortly afterwards there was a violent thunderstorm, and it so happened that we thought it was a thunder, you know, flash, one of those things. On another occasion, I was in Hammersmith having been dancing and missed the last train. So I had to put up somewhere, and the only place was Rowton House. Now, Rowton House, I don't know if you're familiar with them. Rowton House was a chain of, I wouldn't call them hotels, an accommodation facility for mainly down and outs. They had huge dormitories subdivided into separate cabins, the walls of which did not reach the ceiling, but they had strong wires across, so that you could hear in your own little corner what was going on in the room where there were maybe 60 men sleeping. I put up there for the night, and it was, well, you had a sort of semi-clean blanket and a pillow and so on, and I was happily lying there and listening to all the cacophony of sound, the snoring and farting and talking in their sleep and all that from all these people, when suddenly there was an enormous crash because the alarm had gone earlier, and I thought, I'm not staying up here anymore, I'm getting out. And I got up and I went down below and I watched ambulances shooting by, and one of these V2s had landed not too far from Hammersmith Hospital, and they were ferrying the injured there and so on. Not funny, because it's very strange. After the explosion you could hear the sound of the thing coming, because they were faster than sound, they flew. I saw some more when they served at sea. And then I just saw them in the air going from horizon to horizon. It was most amazing. Yes, so what else is there that I did that was naughty?
Was all the work you were doing at South Mead just training?
It was just training, practicing and all the rest of it. We had to do this to get ourselves absolutely word perfect and well... and sort of well informed and adjusted to this, what was required. There's one little thing I do want to mention still. On one of my days ashore, I had arranged to meet this girlfriend. She was a steady girlfriend by that time. I had arranged to meet her in town and said I would take her to the pictures, to the cinema, somewhere near Leicester Square, Piccadilly, in that area. And when we met, she brought along her brother, who was serving in the army in the Middle East and was home on leave, and he was engaged, and he brought along his fiancée. So the four of us went to the pictures. And after that, we decided to go and eat out. So I suggested there wasn't much opportunity for eating, and I suggested Joe Lyons, or J. Lyons & Co., Joe Lyons, it was commonly known, in Leicester Square. They had a series of restaurants in one building. There was a salad bar and a cafe and I don't know what else, vegetarian place maybe, but also a proper restaurant where they served hot food. So we went into that. It was a bit crowded, but a friendly old waiter found us a table. And I'd noticed that some people had been eating roast lamb. And that was unusual because that sort of thing was very much in short supply. They usually what you could hope for was whale steak, which was like, it looked like a steak. That was about the only thing it had in common with steak. It tasted of old boots or something like that. It was very tough. But I said to the waiter, oh, we'll have four portions of roast lamb. He said, I'm sorry, sir, they're all gone. I said, look, my friend's just come back on leave from the Middle East. I said, I'm on survivor's leave. My ship was sunk last week. Can't you do something special for us? I said, I'll make sure you'll be all right. So I said, well, I'll see what I can do. And promptly came along and brought us four portions of roast lamb with all the trimmings, saying these were actually put aside for the staff, but... And, of course, I greased his palm generously as a result. And as we were eating this, my girlfriend's brother said, oh, Ralph, he said, you'd make a wonderful brother-in-law. Needless to say, it was the end of that particular romance. But in any case, I was posted to my ship a few days after that and never took the opportunity to say goodbye to her. When the happy day came that I was summoned to see the duty officer, to be told I had been assigned to HMS Holderness, Hunt-class destroyer Mark I, based at Sheerness in the Thames Estuary, and a member of the 21st Destroyer Flotilla. I was over the moon. So I got all my gear together, got myself down to Sheerness, reported to the dockyard gate. They took me to a jetty and said, wait here, the Liberty boat from the Holderness will pick you up. They'd obviously radioed across, and soon the boat came chugging along, the motorboat. They called my name, got my gear on board, and drove to one of the various destroyers swinging from buoys in the middle of the estuary. This one was called L-48, which was our number, and helped me to clamber up the side on board. And of course, in the time honored way, I saluted the quarterdeck, was received by a chief petty officer, a few details about getting myself registered on board and so on, and then they took me down to my mess. I was in number 3 mess, which was in the stern of the ship. And the mess consisted of about 20 men who were living in a space not much bigger than this room, a little bit, let's say 50% bigger than this room. It was a bit longer and a bit narrower. You had hooks on the deckheads where you slung your hammocks. We had benches and a table. The table could be collapsed, but a table and benches with a sort of thin... mattress type thing on it, well, cover on it. And I was introduced to the leading seaman, who was the senior man in the mess, leading seaman Ginger Bradley was his name. And he showed me around and told me what to do and told me that the ship's cook was a member of our mess, which was very lucky. And then he said, you get to know the boys. We weren't going to sea that evening, so there were, a lot of them were ashore. You get to know everybody, so just fit in and follow and ask if you don't know, which I did. I found out, and also been told, that a fellow headache operator or writer special was already serving on this ship. We were to serve as a pair. And this chap came and introduced himself. His name was Tony Standish. Was a ladies hairdresser by profession and later became one of the senior people on the staff of the famous Mr. Teasy Weezy Raymond. In fact, he ran their Bournemouth operation. Not that I kept in touch with him, but I heard about it through another friend of mine. He was a nice bloke, and as we were off duty and nothing much to do, he took me right round the ship, showed me everything, engine room, boiler room. You couldn't just walk into an engine room or boiler room because there was a lot of heat and all the rest of it. So these were always entered via an airlock. An airlock being a tube with some rungs down one side with a door that was secure, you know, which sealed properly at the top with a window in it. You looked into this window. If there was nothing going on in the airlock, you opened the door, you clambered in, shut the door after you locked it, then went down, looked through the window at the bottom and exited into the engine room or boiler room and again shut the door. If both doors were open simultaneously, you'd have a blowback from the boilers and the possibility of an explosion. So one had to be very circumspect. I found out that the total complement of HMS Holderness was 183 officers and men, that the ship displaced 1,000 tons, that our armament consisted of twin 4-inch guns forward and aft, a multiple pom-pom, sort of halfway between the after bigger gun 4-inch and the funnel on a platform, and the pom-poms, they spat out shells maybe 2 inches in diameter, something like that. And the actual four barrels ended in sort of a trumpet shape. And they operated alternatively. When they were being fired, they went jump, 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 in series, you see. We had a single one right in the bows, right in the front of the ship. And there were two Oerlikon guns, which were more accurate and with possibly slightly smaller shells than the pom-poms, on either side of the superstructure of the weather bridges of the forecastle. Apart from that, we had depth charges. No torpedoes, we were too small. We were actually a Hunt Mark I, which was the first of the series. And to call them destroyers was flattering. It really was an escort vessel. But later on, they had Mark II, Mark III, Mark IV, which were more sophisticated, some were bigger. They're very good workhorses and very tough little boats, I must say. Our top speed was something like 28, 29 knots. And at that stage, there would be about 2 inches of oil in the engine from thing coming out of pipes, leaking pipes and so on. The crew struck me as being very young. I mean, I was 19. And the others, they were all 18, 19, most of the seamen in the mess. And I settled in very well with one exception. There was an older bloke whom everybody called Pop. His name actually was Eldridge. And Pop was an able seaman, built like a brick wall. Not all that tall, maybe 5'10", something like that. But he was nearly as wide as that as well. He was a big fellow. And he and I fell foul of each other because I'd been told by the leading seaman, or in the Navy they call them a killick, killicks are leading seamen, that I could sling my hammock on those two hooks, they're free, because I didn't want to go somewhere. So I did that, went out for a shower. When I came down from the shower, come off the hooks, slung in a corner in a heap, and Pop Eldridge had installed himself there. I hadn't met him up till then. So I said, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize I was in your space. Ginger told me to sling my hammock here. Well, it was wrong, sort of thing, very aggressive. And then he started to make anti-Semitic remarks to me, which I greatly resented. He said, you Yids only come on board when half the fighting is over, you know, so they can say you've seen active service, that sort of thing. And I was furious because as a child or a young boy, I had suffered persecution in Germany on a considerable scale up to the age of 13 or 12 and had to fight my own battles and so on, and I'd seen what Nazism was all about. And I told him that very politely, but quite firmly, just to put him in his place, but it had no effect. He kept on muttering about bloody Yids and so on. So I thought, I'll ignore the fellow. But it was impossible to ignore me. He took umbrage for some reason at my presence and went out of his way to make my life a misery. If I was somewhere walking along and he was walking in the same area, he would deliberately barge into me. When I was coming up from the mess up to the upper deck, which is by vertical ladder, well, rungs. And he was up there and wanted to come down. And I was halfway up the ladder. He just put his foot on top of my head and forced me to go down so that he could go down before I went up. And he generally went out of his way to make my life a misery. So I went for an option, which was open to sailors in those days anyway. I put in a request for a grudge fight. Grudge fights were held in harbour. A boxing ring was set up amidships somewhere, and the contestants, under supervision with boxing gloves, were required to fight 3 1-minute rounds, at the end of which the rule was you had to shake hands, the cause of your dispute had to be forgotten and not resurrected at any time in future, as this would lead to disciplinary action. I put in for this fight to the duty officer, who referred me to the first lieutenant, or Jimmy the One. And I was summoned to the first lieutenant's cabin, and he said, "What's going on there?" And so on. I explained. He said, "Look, Gartenberg, if you go in the boxing ring with this fellow, he'll make mincemeat out of you, and it won't solve your problem. You've got to solve your problem in another way, diplomatically." I refused to sanction a gunshot. So I went back somewhat chastened, and I started thinking about maybe I should ask for a transfer from the ship. But something happened which put an end to this particular episode. We were at Sheerness, and about half the crew were ashore. We were not going out that night. I was on duty in the watch, and he was in the same watch, in his seaman's watch. And when we finished our duties, we were just in the mess. We could do what we liked, eat, smoke, drink, talk to each other, and so on, read. And he walked in and he said, "Anybody for a game of crib?" You know, cribbage. There were two young sailors in my mess who were sitting at the table. "Yes, Pop, I'll play." "Yes, Pop, I'll play," says the other. "Oh, we need another one," says Pop. Ignored me, of course. I didn't put my name forward. And he was just about to go off looking in other messes to find another bloke, because we paid for pennies or something, when one of the other chaps said, "What's wrong with Izzy?" Which was my nickname. The three Jewish ratings on board were called A, B, I, K, and Izzy. I was Izzy because I used to sing. And very reluctantly, "Oh, all right, then we'll have him, you know." I thought, "Oh, I'm in for a hell of a time here." I was good at cribbage. I'm quite good at cards anyway. And we drew for partners. Well, sod's law, I drew him. "You better play well or else," you know, threatening gestures and so on. We're playing for money. Anyway, he and I ran out winners to the tune of about 1 and 8 pence each, or whatever it was. And I thought, "Oh, well, I haven't done myself any harm." And he suddenly turns around to me and he says, "You're not such a bad kid after all." And turns to the other, "Do you want to return sometime?" And from that day onwards, that man completely changed. That was such a volte face like you've never seen. I became his protected by him. He went out of his way to see that nothing happened to me. He was so friendly. If somebody accidentally barged into me, "Oi, leave my mate alone." We became best mates as a result of this particular game of crib. And when, after the end of the war, I left the ship, was due to leave the ship to go to Chatham Barracks for further assignment, because I wasn't needed on board anymore, he insisted that I have his full tot of rum. And I can tell you, you only do that when somebody saved your life or something like that, because there was a strict unofficial rule with a rum ration. If somebody did you a bit of a favour, when your rum ration came round at midday, you'd offer him your mug and say, "You can have sippers." Sippers meant you can wet your lips no more. If you'd done somebody a really big favour, he said, "Have gulpers on me." It meant you a small mouthful. But totters, only if you saved somebody's life. He insisted. I was so scared, because I thought, if I have his ration of rum, my ration of rum, I'll be bronze and list when I get to Chatham, and I'll be on a charge before I've even started. By that time, I was a leading hand, or a killick myself. So I made sure that I left the ship before the rum ration was issued. I lost my rum ration on that day as a result. Shall we now get down to...
Were the grudge fights official naval policy? Or
I don't know.
Tradition.
I was just told that they existed. That was one way out, to solve differences in order to make sure. I think if they weren't official, they must have been semi-official, because it was a way of ensuring that the ship's efficiency wasn't impaired by internal strife. I can well believe it was official policy, or whether it was administered individually on board, I don't know. I mean, I only served in destroyers. I did travel for a short time in an aircraft carrier, which was a totally different thing, but I was on passage, although they made me work. That was after the war. But there were a couple of other incidents worth mentioning. I've come to the actual naval part after I've done with the odds and ends. There was a petty officer on board who was in charge of mess decks. He was generally known as Tojo, that being the Japanese Prime Minister's name. He was universally hated and disliked. He was a nasty, scruffy, creepy sort of fellow, and everybody steered clear of him. And I had a very unfortunate run-in with him, because I went down to the heads, as the toilets are called, below, and was standing there relieving myself, when without any warning, suddenly, from behind, I was, shall we say, sexually molested in a no uncertain manner. And I just, without looking or thinking, I turned around and punched. And I hit this fellow straight on the nose, and it was Tojo. We were alone. There was no witness. And his nose bled. And he said, "Have you on a charge, you bastard?" You know. And I could see myself finishing up doing, as we call it, jankers. I went and saw one of the senior chief petty officers. I can't remember if it was the chief bosun or the chief gunner's mate or the coxswain, one of those, and told him about this incident. And I said, "He's going to put me on a charge in front of the skipper." So he said, "Oh, he's been at it again," sort of thing. I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, he's had the reputation of a couple of the young lads have mentioned in the past that he's tried it on with them," sort of thing. So I said, "Well, if I have to go in front of the captain, would you be prepared to speak up for me? You know me, I'm properly behaved rating." He said, "Of course," he said. "It's time somebody put a stop to that man." True enough, captain's defaulters next morning, the worst thing that can possibly happen to you. So I stood outside in a short queue of about two. And when my turn came, marched in, saluted smartly, stood attention, "Off caps," or, you know. And he was in there. And so was this chief petty officer, who promised to be a sort of character witness for me. And Tojo then said to the skipper that he was going about his business in the below decks, when I was in there, and I suddenly turned around and smacked him across the face. So the captain asked me, "What do you have to say to this?" And I said, "It's a tissue of lies, sir. I was in the heads relieving myself, and this man attacked me from behind. I didn't know who he was. I just turned around and hit out." Turned to him, "Is that true?" "Not a word of it, sir." "Chief Petty Officer, what have you got to say?" "Well, blah, blah, blah." And he told him that there had been remarks made about this man in the past, and that nobody had ever complained about me in any sort of way or form in that way, and that he personally felt that I was totally in the right. So the captain issued me a verbal warning and told me to leave. And as I was leaving, as I'd gone and shut the cabin door, I could hear him losing his temper with his petty and shouting, "If I ever hear one more thing like that, I'll have you reduced to the ranks and slung off this bloody ship." He tried at a future time to get his revenge on me, because we used to have church parades on board. Every Sunday divisions, everything had to be spick and span. It was Church of England to the after mess deck, Roman Catholics to the forward mess decks, non-conformists and Methodists to the stoker's mess decks. And we were all standing on parade at attention, and they all peeled off and disappear to these various mess decks for Sunday prayers, which left three Jewish ratings standing in odd place on the upper deck, and they used to say other denominations dismiss. Well, on this particular one occasion, when that happened, the petty officer sent everybody to their various mess deck, but forgot to mention other denominations dismiss. So, in theory, we had to stand on the deck in the wintry breeze until an officer came and dismissed us, but we'd all gone to prayers. So when everybody was out of sight, I just said, all other denominations dismiss, and marched off. I went to the wireless cabin to have a chat with a duty sparker or telegraphist, because it had been my training and I was still interested enough that I wasn't using this knowledge anymore. And we were chatting. The others had disappeared to various corners, and suddenly the doors flung open, and who's standing there? Told you. Gartenberg, you weren't dismissed. Report immediately to the after mess deck, the Church of England service. I said, I'm not Church of England. I'm ordering you to report down there. And I knew the telegraphist wasn't going to be a witness in his favour, because he was universally hated. So I just pushed him out of the way, shot round the gangway, round the corner, went down an airlock into the engine room, and he didn't catch on. I think, I don't know whether he fell over or not, but he didn't sort of seem to follow me. I disappeared down below in the engine room, and I said to the duty engine room artificer, I said, for God's sake, he said, if Tojo comes, you've not seen me. He said, look, you go there and there and there, he won't find you there. You stay out of sight. And I stayed out of sight there till I could hear the clomp of boots on the deck, knowing that the services were over, and I reappeared. My last encounter with that particular man was after I'd left the ship, when I had a fight with him in Sheerness and left him in a flower bed, slightly worse for wear. There were so many things that were interesting to me, other than the actual work we were doing. The rum ration, for example. We were allocated rum. You either took your rum if you were 18 or over, or you got 3 old pence per day in lieu. I, of course, opted for rum. I like to drink rum. It's a very nice drink, actually. Makes you lovely and sleepy. And it was always issued at lunchtime. And on our ship, the routine was you had one in one, as it was called. It was one part water, one part rum mixed. On many of the big ships, like cruisers, battleships, aircraft carriers, they used to give 3 of water to 1 of rum, which is nothing. Of course, we got Jamaica rum mainly, which was excellent stuff. But sometimes we were given Australian rum, which was referred to generally as gnat's piss. It was useless. And we always used to happily swap 2 barrels of that for 1 of Jamaica with other ships that weren't so fussy. And the rum ration, of course, was sacrosanct. One bod in our mess was rum bosun for the week. You had to go at 12 o'clock to collect rum in mugs. And they were all measured out with special measures by the petty officer in charge of this. And the rule was that if after all the rum had been dished out, there was any left over, it should be dumped overboard. Not that I ever heard of anybody doing anything as stupid as that. And you had to be careful, because it's a small ship, and especially if the weather is a bit heavy, not to spill it, because if you lost 14 or 15 rum rations through stumbling or falling down the ladder, you were responsible for replacing these for the next month or so.